This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life,
and all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the book-lined, chart-strewn chamber where, inside 28 minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, an election shock in the Republic of Ireland has put one party firmly in the headlines, Sinn Féin. But in 2020, who are Sinn Féin? Times have changed on the island of Ireland. Remember Gerry Adams?
When I was putting this book together, there were numbers of suggestions for what we would call it. Long quiche, the peas process, come out you rack of lambs. But we settled for the negotiator's cookbook. It's a must for every kitchen cabinet.
Gerry Adams, once closely associated with the Provisional IRA, turned recipe provider. And now, in a big shock, the party he led, Sinn Féin, has won more votes than anyone else in last weekend's Irish election. So who are Sinn Féin today, and what do they now represent? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Let's begin with Saturday's election in Ireland, the results on Sunday, and the campaign that preceded both. Naomi O'Leary presents a podcast, The Irish Passport, and is a correspondent with Politico Europe. Naomi O'Leary, as far as we can tell, who actually voted in this election for Sinn Féin?
They're the most popular party in the opinion poll among all sectors of the electorate under the age of 65. If we break it down, we can see that the younger the voter, the more likely they were to vote for Sinn Féin. So they had their highest support in the 18 to 24-year-old age group, followed by the up to 35s. The defining issue of this campaign for Sinn Féin was housing. And this is the section of the population that has been most severely affected by a serious housing crunch. So young people are paying exorbitant rents. They're prevented from getting on the housing ladder. If they can ever get a mortgage, it looks like they'll still be paying it off after they've retired.
You said that the youngest were most likely to vote for Sinn Féin. But you also said that not just the youngest, but also middle-aged people were quite likely to vote for them, who presumably don't have such worries.
It makes sense because the shortage of housing and the enormous housing costs are so severe that it's not just affecting the youngest people. It's not just affecting lower paid people either. It extends right into the middle classes. So what you have is you have young people unable to move out of home, living with their parents. Sometimes you have them starting families. Even you've seen the return of multi-generational households with grandchildren living with their grandparents and so on. And when it's as severe as this, it's very difficult not to see it. I mean, you can see people sleeping in tents around Dublin. And really, Sinn Féin owned the issue. They were the party that campaigned on a platform of a rent freeze and also what they said would be the biggest public housing building programme in the history of the state.
Irish politics has been dominated, hasn't it, by two parties that we don't really quite have a corollary for in the United Kingdom. You might remind us of who those two parties are.
So what we have is two parties that have been dominant for about the last century. They're called Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. The difference between them is that Fine Gael, which is led by Leo Varadkar, is less willing to spend. They pride themselves on fiscal rectitude, but they're also more socially progressive. So they've introduced the key liberal reforms of equal marriage and legalised abortion. you might see them as perhaps most similar to Cuddly Cameron era. You remember Cuddly David Cameron when he was sort of progressive, but also he was going to balance the books. Perhaps that's the closest thing you might find in the UK system to Fine Gael.
So Fianna Fáil is more socially conservative and Fine Gael is more socially liberal. And Fianna Fáil is a little bit more progressive, you might call it, economically. And Fine Gael is a bit more what we might call conservative economically.
Fianna Fáil are less afraid of spending and they have a traditionally conservative streak. They're quite popular with older voters. You might see them as analogous to one of the Christian parties of Europe. So they would have, you know, the tradition of having sort of Catholic social beliefs, but they'd be more willing to open the purse strings.
Well, why did Sinn Féin make more progress than Fianna Fáil?
Fianna Fáil was for a long time the dominant party in Ireland until the financial crisis of 2008, after which the economy collapsed. And Fianna Fáil is still very much associated with that. They're still blamed for that collapse. They were in power at the time. And they're not strongly differentiated from Fine Gael because since 2016, they've been in a governing arrangement together. So Fine Gael has had a minority government that's been allowed to continue by Fianna Fáil that's basically abstained or supported it in key votes.
So the people who ended up supporting Sinn Féin simply didn't believe that these two parties would deliver because they hadn't in the past?
Yeah, essentially there was a big change wind blowing this election. Sinn Féin successfully cast Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael as essentially they call them the Tweedledum and Tweedledee of Irish politics, that there's no difference between them. And Sinn Féin was successfully able to make the argument that if you want a change, we are the party to vote for and we're the ones that can deliver that change.
Now, did you and other close observers of the Irish political scene expect this result?
I reported that there was a Sinn Féin surge in the polls about, 10 days out from the poll. However, it's also worth pointing out that the party's performance came as the biggest surprise, perhaps, to Sinn Féin itself. They didn't run enough candidates to properly capitalise on the level of votes that they got. So they only actually ran 42 candidates, which is well short of the 80 that you need to form a majority in the Irish Parliament. And that was a huge blunder for them that essentially stopped them from gaining the seats that they could have.
Naomi O'Leary. Let's look more closely at what Sinn Féin is, beginning with where it's come from. Roy Foster, Professor Emeritus at Oxford University, is one of Ireland's most celebrated historians. Roy, where shall we begin the story of Sinn Féin?
It begins as a little pressure group that's set up to oppose Britain's role in the Boer War in Ireland, but it is cranky, it is protectionist, it is all for national purity. There's a strong whiff of anti-Semitism about it, as there often is about groups who take this line on the Boer War. And it becomes a fringe political party in Edwardian Ireland until the great tectonic shift of allegiances and politics that follow Ireland's entry into the First World War. And then in the post-war election in 1918, Sinn Féin, as it has now become, which is a kind of coagulation of all sorts of elements in Irish nationalism, sweeps the board and the old centrist, home rule, moderate nationalist party is dispatched.
Now, this is a 1918 election for the Westminster Parliament.
Yes, but what Sinn Féin do then is they use the mandate to withdraw and set up a revolutionary assembly in Ireland. And that's what begins the Irish Revolution, really, from 1919 to 21.
And what happens to them after a setting up of their own assembly?
The nationalist alliance fragments over the terms of the treaty with Britain in 1921. There's a civil war. And it's from that you get the two major political parties to this day, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Fine Gael are the less extreme nationalist party who accept the treaty, who work within the Commonwealth in which Ireland is a dominion under the treaty. Fianna Fáil are the more extreme, more republican party. But essentially, ideologically, as the years go by, there's less and less between them. Sinn Féin is banished to the margins, the rump of Sinn Féin, who think even Fianna Fáil aren't extreme enough.
So it is the party that thinks that the terms of the independence agreement are no good because they don't include the North?
Yes, and because they keep Ireland within the ambit of the Commonwealth in Britain in the 1920s and 30s. In 1948-9, of course, Ireland peacefully takes itself out of the Commonwealth. But to say Sinn Féin is a party, David, is to, I think, ignore a number of interesting elisions and disappearances. Sinn Féin is more a name and an identity that people will attach themselves to proclaim that they are extreme Republican, that they will have nothing to do with the British state, that partition is a major injustice and that can't even be recognised.
What does the name mean and why was it chosen?
It means we ourselves, or as it's roughly translated, ourselves alone. And the name will reemerge attached to the provisional IRA in the 1970s. It is reborn or recreated when the IRA decides it needs a political wing and a political voice, notably in the great upheaval over the hunger strikes in the early 1980s, when IRA prisoners die on hunger strike in northern jails. And the IRA began contesting elections, by-elections in Ireland, using the Sinn Féin name as their political wing.
I see. So Sinn Féin effectively disappears as an organisation. The provisional IRA comes about when, in the late 60s?
1969 to 70, really.
And then they recreate a Sinn Féin themselves.
The name is there to occupy, if you like. But the idea of extreme Republican independence and of severing all ties with Britain, that is the ideological continuity that goes back to the early Sinn Féin.
So the Provisional IRA have been operating since the beginning of what came to be known as the Troubles. Why in the 80s did they decide they needed a Sinn Féin?
They began to realise that, well, the famous phrase was that with an Armalite, that is a machine gun in one hand and the ballot box in the other, they would take power in Ireland. There was a sense that there would be electoral support to be gained, and this proved slowly to be true. Much more, of course, in Northern Ireland than in the Republic, where Sinn Féin did extremely badly over those years in electoral terms. It's been a very slow build, and that's one reason why the enormous success in last weekend's election came as a surprise. That reminds one of the great 1918 overturning of the moderate nationalists by the wave of Sinn Féin. As in 1918, it's something of a youthquake, disillusioned with the centrist parties. Also allied to the fact that the new supporters are young, they don't remember what the IRA stood for. They don't remember today's Sinn Féin originally came into being as the support group of people who are blowing up shopping centres and so forth. It's a way in which Sinn Féin are rebranding themselves as they have rebranded themselves through history. There have also been implicit disagreements, especially a couple of decades ago, about social policy. Old-style Sinn Féin people would have been anti-abortion, would have been anti-gay rights. New-style Sinn Féin attaches itself to equal marriage and a woman's right to choose. That's quite an ideological shift, but it also reflects, I think, a demographic shift in the age of the people who are supporting the party. It also points up a way in which new-style Sinn Féin is rebranding itself. It's effectively stolen the clothes of the Labour Party.
So Sinn Féin is also now, amongst all the other things it is, Labour in Southern Ireland.
I think it will become so. As usual, they have managed to rebrand and change and domesticate themselves into Southern politics.
Roy, do you think it's important for any future success for Sinn Féin that essentially people forget the violent past and say, we've just moved beyond that?
Someone once suggested that Ireland should put up a statue to amnesia and then forget where they put it, and that this would be the way we should approach the modern world. But political psychology doesn't work like that. Ireland was a revolutionary state. It became conservative so quickly for all sorts of reasons, a large one being the Roman Catholic Church and the part it played in the new state. We've been involved in a decade of commemoration, most notably in 2016, of the foundational act of the Irish state, which was the Easter Rebellion, failed at the time, but successful in a certain sense in retrospect. I've been encouraged by the inclusiveness and maturity with which the commemorations, especially of 1916, took place. there was a kind of openness towards other traditions, people who thought it was a bad idea at the time, and the losers in history who were sidelined, the conventional moderate nationalist home rulers who were sidelined. The commemorations and the remembrance get edgier and dodgier as you move into the more violent period. We have to go on remembering these things. I'm not entirely convinced that we will remember the Civil War in as reflective, mature and inclusive a way as we managed to remember 1916.
Professor Roy Foster. It's time to look at Sinn Féin right now and how its success might change things in Ireland, Northern Ireland and relations with Britain. I'm joined by Dr. Margaret O'Callaghan, historian and political analyst from Queen's University Belfast, Brian Feeney, historian and author, they're both in Belfast, and Dr. Teresa Reedy from University College Cork. Teresa Reedy, Sinn Féin is the only major party that straddles both Northern Ireland and the Republic. Is it the same party in both places?
Well, I think it contests elections on a very different platform in the Republic, and its expansion at the weekend was certainly rooted in its manifesto and its promises, which are directly related to social and economic issues, housing, healthcare, transport infrastructure. And I think in general, Sinn Féin in the Republic, it draws far less on its kind of nationalist dimensions than it would do, for example, when it's contesting elections in Northern Ireland. So they are one party, but they certainly draw their support from different bases and campaign quite differently on the two different parts of the island. Of course, it has a single leader, President Mary Lou MacDonald, but there is also, of course, a leader in the Assembly in Northern Ireland, and Mary Lou MacDonald is the leader in the Dáil. So there are, if you want, leadership structures which cover both sides, but there is certainly an overarching integrated Ard Comhairle which oversees the whole party.
Margaret O'Callaghan.
Sinn Féin have had an agenda since 1998, which is to be significant actors north and south of the border. It is an integrated party at the highest level, and it has, I suppose, aims of taking power in both parts of Ireland.
Can you tell us a bit more about Mary Lou MacDonald? Because people in Britain don't really know much about her.
Well, Mary Lou MacDonald is young-ish, intelligent, highly personable, very articulate, persuasive politician. She's a middle-class Dublin girl. She carries no baggage from Sinn Féin's history north of the border. She's a new face and she's a very able politician.
Why would somebody like her have joined Sinn Féin in the first place?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think she was originally in the Fianna Fáil party, but I think at that time it was so difficult for a woman to progress within the Fianna Fáil party. And obviously, politically, she found herself more attracted to Sinn Féin.
Brian, how does Mary Lou MacDonald deal with that past and its association with the IRA?
Well, she's ambivalent about it, really. She quite often goes to commemorations, makes speeches at commemorations of IRA men who've been killed in the Troubles and earlier than that again. But basically, her position is the war is over, the IRA has gone away, and the Republican movement is exclusively peaceful and democratic. Until the election recently, this has never been fully accepted. It has always been thrown at her during the course of election campaigns. Mary Lou MacDonald, as all senior figures in Sinn Féin do, must regard the past and the IRA activity as something which they do not apologise for.
I recall, having been a journalist who covered this in the past, that there was always this thing that Sinn Féin was one thing and the IRA was another, and then it transpired that the IRA was always in the background running things. Is there anything like what the IRA used to be that is still in the background of Sinn Féin, the political organisation, Brian?
Well, senior police in the north will say that the Army Council has been put to bed, but it hasn't gone asleep. there are senior figures who were in the IRA, who were senior in the IRA, and in many places have acted as advisors. There are people, for example, in the Northern Assembly, like Conor Murphy, who's the Minister of Finance, who was a senior IRA figure in South Armagh. Gerry Kelly, who was Adjutant General of the IRA, is a senior figure in the Assembly in Northern Ireland. But the IRA, and the police will say this, the IRA no longer exists as a military organisation. That does not identify targets. It doesn't collect intelligence. They have devoted all their activities to the political aspect of the Republican movement. They are not engaged in any kind of military operations or military preparations.
It's clearly the case that for some large number of politicians in the South, the whole question of whether or not the Army Council has completely gone away as a potential source of political direction, influence and steerage is a key question.
Now, Teresa, in the South, do Sinn Féin still agitate actively for a united Ireland? Is that a kind of big part of what they suggest?
It's their core platform, and of course they're very heavily identified with that issue. But in terms of public debate and discussion in the Republic, you know, United Ireland makes a very rare appearance on the agenda. It's domestic issues, of course, that are to the forefront of debate. And Sinn Féin spokespersons are really focused in on these issues. And actually, some of them are very proficient and far ahead of the other opposition spokespersons. So, I mean, I think everybody knows that United Ireland is part of their core ambition, but it's certainly not to the forefront of debate and discussion in the Republic. United Ireland kind of comes up occasionally. I suppose it has increased in terms of the emphasis or attention paid to it in recent years, but that's because of Brexit. It's not because of any kind of rise in nationalist sentiment in the Republic.
Margaret O'Callaghan.
The key thing to remember about this victory, and you know, it's a partial victory for Sinn Féin, is that it is in a way a product of significant shifts in the Irish electoral landscape over about the last 30 years. The two big parties that have dominated Irish politics, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have been between them getting a lesser and lesser share of the vote for about the last 20 years. Also, Brexit kind of created its own momentum in terms of southern politics because Fine Gael were propped up in power by Fianna Fáil, ostensibly in the national interest, to follow the whole Brexit situation in a European and British context. Now, what that meant was that at the election, where people were deeply dissatisfied and justifiably so, they could paint both of these big parties as selfish, middle class, obnoxious. So in a bizarre way, Brexit facilitated Sinn Féin in a broader and more popular campaign in the South.
If Sinn Féin do form part of the next coalition government, what difference do we think that's going to make? Teresa?
First of all, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether Sinn Féin will form the next government, and it's by no means certain that they will be in the next government. I think it's important also to add Brexit and the way it has played out has actually brought quite a high degree of cross-party consensus in the Republic among all the political parties about the negotiating position that was adopted. So Mr. Varadkar had the support not just of Fianna Fáil through the confidence and supply, but broadly speaking, Sinn Féin actually also agreed with the kind of core negotiating positions that were put forward. So we have some sense of what Sinn Féin would like to see achieved, and we can all kind of guess as to where that would be. I guess if Sinn Féin are actually in the government, we would expect them to take a stronger line perhaps on the question of the All-Ireland economy, insisting on there being no barriers to trade between North and South, and possibly we think negotiations might become more complex as a consequence of Sinn Féin being in government. But Sinn Féin must tread a very delicate path in the Republic, because the source of its success at the election really is to do with its policies and housing and healthcare. Sinn Féin would run risk of losing some of that support if it was to kind of put national issues front and centre to the detriment of other policy developments. So it would be a very delicate balance for Sinn Féin.
Now, Brian, what's the actual mechanism that would allow a border poll to be called?
It says in the Good Friday Agreement, the Secretary of State shall call a referendum if he believes that there is likely to be a majority of people in favour of Irish unity. So he must do it. And the agreement also states that the British government and the Irish government will bring in legislation to facilitate that. But there are two referendums. They have to be concurrent. So there has to be one in the Irish Republic as well as in the North, in which case both governments would have to agree on the question or questions.
And how on earth would the Secretary of State decide that?
The Secretary of State has been asked repeatedly by particularly Sinn Féin, but also other nationalist parties in the North, what would be his criteria? Would it be a new census report? Would it be several assembly elections with a nationalist majority? And no Secretary of State has said what the criteria would be. We don't know what they are.
Teresa.
If I could just add in there, actually, just drawing from the exit poll that we had at the election at the weekend, there was actually a question in there which asked voters as they were leaving the polling station whether there should be referendums north and south in the next 5 years on Irish unity or not. And 57% said there should be referendums. And the pattern actually across the parties is exactly as you would expect. Among Sinn Féin supporters, 81% think there should be a referendum on unity. But actually among Fine Gael supporters, it's just 44%. So there's small but majority in favour of looking at this issue over the next 5 years.
Now, people in the South could know that, but people in the North might conceivably see a difference. If Sinn Féin was actually in the Irish government, would that make any difference, Brian, to the way in which Stormont and the way in which that arrangement is seen in the North?
Well, I think the arrangement will remain the same, but if Sinn Féin were to be in government, there are various aspects of the arrangement. For example, the North-South Ministerial Council, where ministers across the spectrum in terms of agriculture, trade, tourism, whatever, they meet, are supposed to meet on a regular basis. And if we get to the situation where there is a Sinn Féin minister from Stormont meeting a Sinn Féin minister from Dublin across the table devising an All-Ireland policy, that will destabilise unionism. There is no doubt about it. They will be wondering what these people are up to and what they're proposing, and will try to veto that sort of an arrangement or any arrangement that arrives out of that.
If I could add in just a more broader background about governing in the Republic. Governing in the Republic has become a very hazardous business for the political parties that have been involved in that process. Fianna Fáil were effectively vastly diminished as an electoral force in 2011. The Green Party lost all of its seats in Parliament at the height of the crisis. Fine Gael and a Labour Party went into government at that point. At the next election in 2016, the Labour Party were all but wiped out. So governing is very difficult. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Labour Party, Green Party, they've all suffered extreme losses over the last decade. So there is also a question for Sinn Féin about how it's going to balance its short-term ambitions of going into government and delivering. But that could indeed be at a cost of compromising its longer-term ambitions, which is continued growth in the Republic.
Margaret O'Callaghan, if I was the new Northern Ireland Secretary appointed today, what attitude do you think I should take from the outset to what's happening in the Republic?
Cautious observation.
Always good advice. Margaret O'Callaghan there with Brian Feeney and Teresa Reedy. Cautious observation does seem right, and at the very least, Sinn Féin's ascendancy will be one of the first things that the new Secretary of State for Northern Ireland will want to take into account. My thanks to Naomi O'Leary, Roy Foster, Margaret O'Callaghan, Brian Feeney and Teresa Reedy. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The programme producers were Kirsty Knight, Rosamund Jones and Jordan Dunbar. It was mixed by James Beard. And the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on the Revolutionary Guard of Iran, how to make a trade deal and the real risks from coronavirus. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.